Welcome to the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Joan Legeau. Now, big tech companies like Google profit from much of the activity that occurs on the internet. Would your experiences online be better if there was more competition and choices? Well, we're going to talk about that today with Beth DeAngelo. She is a senior IT specialist in UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, and she's here to tell us how recent court rulings against Google could affect internet users. And of course, we're going to answer your tech questions too, so give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hi, Beth. Good to hear from you again.
Good morning, Jill. Thanks for having me.
You bet. So, last month, and it seems like it wasn't that long ago, but we had that big IT outage and it affected millions of people. What happened?
Yeah, that was a really big deal. Some folks are saying it's kind of the largest IT mishap in recent history or in history at all. So lots of impact to many different parts of the world. I think something that was really well known amongst folks is all of the airline issues that were happening at the time. A lot of the major airlines rely on operating systems and software that were impacted by the outage caused by the CrowdStrike fault, and that really disrupted travel and hospitals and law enforcement agencies and governments and businesses all across the world. So it's a pretty big deal in our IT world.
So it came from an update from CrowdStrike, right?
It did, yeah. CrowdStrike is a cybersecurity software package that Microsoft has installed on a pretty high percentage of its machines out there, a lot of its server systems. Those server systems then host applications that folks use, a lot of cloud-based applications that folks are using. And when those server systems are taken offline by a faulty update, the software packages that they serve out to companies or to the public are not available. And this one was particularly difficult to recover from because it wasn't something that was an easy rollback to an original state or an update that you could easily remove from that system.
Okay. Does this incident really suggest that maybe too much of the world supply chain is a little reliant on some IT technology?
Yeah, I think what it does is it highlights, you know, the fact that a lot of sectors have all their eggs in one basket. Kind of go all in on vendors who provide solutions that cover a wide range of tasks or business processes within their organization. And when that one vendor has a major problem with systems that impact all of those services, it doesn't just take out one part of your business or one part of your organization, but it really inhibits your ability to complete any of your business processes. So really going in on all on one vendor is kind of coming to the forefront as a possible single point of failure for a lot of organizations.
So what's the thought then? Are they going to get more vendors? I mean, are they going to be able to work together if that's the case?
Yeah, I think really the trend is now highlighting the need to diversify where your IT assets are housed or living to ensure you have more redundance in systems that are relied upon for critical business processes. So, you know, having backup systems that can be tapped into to handle those same processes in the event that your primary or your production system isn't functioning. Having a better continuity of operations plans, so ways to continue your business operations if a certain system is not functional. Is there another method you could use? Or then diversifying the vendors that you're using and kind of spreading out your IT footprint among multiple different vendor companies so that one doesn't take down everything.
And what does that mean to those of us at home with our little computer? what does that mean for us?
Yeah, so the I guess what it really means is when you're using services that are provided to you on a what we call like a cloud services basis, meaning it's not something that's installed directly on your computer at home, something you tap into on the cloud, like your Gmail or your Outlook through your company to get your email. Things like that may be impacted when they're hosted by these large vendors who are relying on other companies to provide pieces of their systems, and they may not have the level of quality assurance or quality control that someone expects. So I think being careful about what services you're relying on for your critical processes, if, you know, whether it's banking or communications or, you know, saving your data, making sure you have backups for those, ways to access that information that aren't a single point of failure.
Okay. So you're thinking more than one vendor that does that, or an external hard drive, or what are some of the better ways to back up?
Yeah, those are all good options. So there are online backup vendors where you can use a cloud service to back up data on your machine so that you can access it in the time of an outage. You could go the route of an external hard drive where you have a piece of backup software loaded locally on your machine that takes a snapshot of the data that you have on your machine and moves that snapshot over to an external hard drive. That way you can restore to the last good version of whatever you are using. Things like that are always good for that continuity of operations to make sure you have access to your services, even if your provider may not have access to them.
Okay, makes sense. Sure. So lots of news in the tech world. Last week, a federal judge ruled that Google illegally quashes, and I don't think I've ever had to use that word before, quashes its competition in the area of internet search. So what does that ruling mean for consumers?
I think really what the ruling is focused on is how Google has paid really significant amounts of money to other large companies to get exclusive rights as the default search engine on devices and on certain web browsers. So if you take a web browser like Safari, for instance, Google can set up an exclusive deal with Mozilla, the company with Apple, so that any Safari browser installed on one of their devices has the default search engine set to Google. Most people don't go in and change that setting. So Google is just de facto the one they use because it's what came with the device that they're using. Google pays a lot of money to companies for those rights. What that does is it really stifles competition and eliminates other browser organizations to search engines to really capture any of the market, because all of the devices that are being sold or all of the browsers that are being used have these exclusive deals with Google to serve Google as the default search engine. And what this decision may end up changing is the ability for Google to do that in the future so that other search engines have an opportunity to get part of that market.
And what did Google have to say about that? What was their defense?
Well, obviously, they're unhappy about it. Their defense really centers around the fact that people use Google because of the quality of the product and not because it's the default that's set up on the systems that they're purchasing or the systems that they're used to using. So they're kind of going with the argument of we're not doing anything to create the situation where Google has 90% market share. Google has 90% market share because of how effective it is. And the monopoly argument says, well, if you do have so much of that market share, it really stifles your need to innovate or problem solve or come up with better, more secure solutions because there is no competition.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the options that we would have? Because like you said, it's almost every time Google comes up first. What are other options instead of using Google if we prefer not to?
Yeah, Bing is obviously another large one out there, and there's question about whether or not Bing is any better than Google because they do a very similar thing through Microsoft where it becomes the default browser in all Microsoft products. So it's kind of trading one for the other. But a lot of folks I know are using the Brave browser and the default search engine through there. There's also DuckDuckGo. Is a great search engine. And then the search engine built into the Tor browser is really effective. So there are a lot of others out there. They're just not very well known because Google has 90% of the market share of search engines.
Well, and when we say let's Google it, I mean, there's advertising right there for them, right? Yeah,
exactly. It's become a verb, right? It's no longer just a noun. It's a verb, and it's really become the, I guess, identifier for an activity. So you don't say, I'm going to search for this on the web. You say, I'm just going to Google it.
Right.
So because it's become so ubiquitous, and many of the other companies are much less known, it's hard for other organizations to break in and create that innovation in the marketplace that really makes products better.
And like you had said earlier, you can go into your computer and change the search engine that comes up. It's not super complicated. You just have to kind of know where to look, right?
Yeah, depending on the browser you're using, there's always going to be a settings option within your browser where you can go and configure to your liking any of the settings that they allow you to customize. And in every browser I've ever used, there is an option to change the default search engine. There's also an option to change the default homepage. So if you don't want Google to come up as your homepage when you first open that browser, you can change that as well.
Mm-hmm. And the federal judge in this case heard testimony that Google alters billions of search queries to generate more commercial results. So what are they doing? So when I put something in, you know, I want to search dog food, how do they change that?
Yeah, this is a little bit less known by folks. Part of the hearings that were going on released some information that I think was very news to folks that use Google as a search engine that, you know, we all know that our search results, when you type something in that Google can suggest, you know, typical search queries for it, or it may give you, if you type something in wrong, it'll say, do you really need to search for XYZ instead? And you can correct it yourself. But now there's evidence, as came up in this trial, the Monopoly trial, that Google is actually changing behind the scenes the terms that you are using to search. So rather than if you were searching for dog food, it using dog food as the search term, it may inject an actual brand name of a dog food company into that search query unbeknownst to you so that the top results that come up are a company that has paid large amounts of advertising dollars to Google to do that, which really feels unethical and like misinformation because it's very subversive. It's happening unbeknownst to you. That search query is being changed behind the scenes.
So when I do search in a Google, the first few things that come up generally are ads, and it will say sponsored. But you're saying it goes even farther than that.
Correct. It's actually changing terms of the search so that, yes, you'll still get that sponsored content coming up first, but then most folks are already aware of that, and it says sponsored under those links. But then the top searches that you will get for a general topic you may have searched for will be, I guess, they'll come back to you as much more specific to the companies that have paid for those advertising spaces without telling you.
Wow. And I thought I was being so sneaky, not clicking on the ads.
Right. Now it's hard to know what are the ads and what aren't the ads. So
exactly.
It feels a bit dishonest and a bit like we're being fed information that we weren't actually asking for.
With us today is Beth D'Angelo. She has worked in information technologies for more than 20 years. She's a senior IT specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. We just talked about some kind of complicated things. So if you have a question about them or if you've got a question about anything else tech-related, give us a call. All the lines are open, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email. That address is talk@WPR.org. Now, coming up at 12:30 today, we're going to talk about the 20th edition of the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show. It's taking place next month in Madison, and Deanna Springer joins us to talk about the legacy of the event, and some 20,000 quilters are expected to attend. So we'll talk about a little bit about what you will see if you do. That's coming up at 12:30 today on The Larry Mueller Show. Right now, we are talking tech with Beth D'Angelo, and we're just talking about Google and some of its legal battles. And this isn't the first time that Google's been in court lately, has it?
No, it seems like it's been a kind of a long series of court battles for Google recently. And, you know, I think now that some of their behind the scenes practices are coming to light, that that may not end anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. We've got a phone call from Jerry in Appleton. Go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, I have a comment, and I'd be interested in both of your reactions. I'm definitely in favor of the Justice Department defanging monopolies. But having said that, my own personal experience sort of agrees with the Google defense, which is their search engine is much better. When I try other search engines, and fairly often I do, specifically Bing, I find that I get more advertising and the hits that I get are further away from what I was actually looking for. And I'll go as far as to say if I try Bing, 90% of the time I don't get what I want, and then I have to go and do the same search using Google. So is this just me, or is that really a thing? That's my question.
Good point, Jerry. What do you think, Beth?
No, I agree. Really, Google does have a strong argument in saying that the product has as much market share as it does because it is the best product out there. I think for many, many years that's been the case. I think what the antitrust lawsuit is trying to do is to, I think, clear the road for competitors to come in and improve their services to a point where they can compete with Google, because creating that competition really raises the level of service delivery for all of the providers that are selling a service like Google. So I think they're really trying to ensure they're stimulating that innovation and research and development to continue to make products better.
Yeah, I've had that exact same result, Jerry, Google versus Bing. It just, and I don't know if it's because I'm used to Google and I know how to search in it, but yeah, I just can't come up with good results when I use Bing. So maybe this will change things.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend trying DuckDuckGo as an option. It certainly has some much higher privacy standards than Bing or Google. You may not get quite the search results, but it definitely has higher privacy standards.
And I think I would miss, though, the little Google cartoon every day. That's my favorite part. They did a great job during the Olympics, got to tell you that.
They really did.
So, now, part of this ruling could be that Google could be forced to allow other companies to use its search technology to create other search engines. That just seems a little not fair to Google. I mean, you know, I know they're the big guys, but why do they need to use their technology or give it to other companies?
I think really what the purpose behind that is, in antitrust law, generally what happens is when companies are found to be violating those laws, they tend to look to split off parts of that company into organizations that can then be less proprietary. So I think they're talking more about the algorithms that are used behind the scenes by Google for driving its search engine could then be spun off into a separate organization that could then be utilized by other search engine organizations to develop their technology. So I think it's more of a how do we break this company up in a way where Google gets to maintain its intellectual property, but then other organizations out there that provide competition for the search engine side can utilize the algorithmic technology that Google has developed.
Okay. So not to just pick on Google today, but during the Olympics, an advertisement from Apple claimed that their search browser, Safari, protects users' privacy. Is that the case?
Yeah, it is to a certain extent. And it's interesting that this is becoming a really big part of selling points for web browsers is the privacy issues that they really have seemed unconcerned with for a couple of decades. So I'm glad that the public have really made it known that this needs to be more of a focus for these companies. I wouldn't say that Safari is the number one in privacy out there. They are getting better. They've stopped tracking what's called cookies, which is really nice. Cookies are little file that collects information about you that it can use to provide to advertisers information about your searching and where you're going on the internet. Tracking cookies are now no longer stored by Safari. But there still are some kinds of tracking that the Safari browser is doing, and it's mainly what's called fingerprinting, which is taking technical details about the device that you're using, capturing those, and then providing them back to the Safari browser database so that it understands what users are employing to access their browser. So what device are you on? What version of the service are you using? You know, things like that. How updated is your device? Mm-hmm. Where are you using it? Those types of things. So it's not tracking where you're web surfing now, but it's tracking things about your device still.
So it's still looking. It's just looking at different things. Okay.
Different things.
Yeah.
Yep.
So every time I go to a new website that I haven't been before, I get a pop-up that asks me about cookies. Now, I can say yes, because I usually do, because I have a feeling that if I said no, it's going to be pretty complicated. Is that the case?
If you say no, the website itself may not function fully as it's intended to, because those cookies may be required for some of the functionality on the website, or it may be required for the website to remember information that you've already filled out on it if you go back to that site. But it really shouldn't inhibit the general experience of the website that you're visiting. What it may cause problems with is filling out online forms or remembering any data that you put into that website previously.
Okay, so if you're lazy like me and always in a hurry, you want that all pre-filled,
try
right?
Try saying no. Right. But try saying no and see what it does. I don't think it'll really alter the experience that much.
Okay, well, I just might. We'll see. If you've got a question about tech, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Diane in Verona emailed to ask how you can see what Google is actually searching for, and can you stop a Google search from adding words to what you type?
That is a very good question. So at this point, those changes are happening behind the scenes, what I would call it. You can't actually see how it's changing your search terms. You can't see that happening in real time. This was only exposed because certain studies were done as part of the antitrust lawsuit to determine if results were different based on search terms and if changing search terms during a search query would make the same result. So that study actually came out and said, yes, we can tell that Google is changing our search terms based on the frequency of this happening within the sample that we studied, but we can't actually see it happening for ourselves right now.
Okay. So some of these big companies, you know, they're trying to win over customers by saying, oh, well, we've got all these privacy features. Do you think that's a good thing?
I think if they're backing it up with real controls that are protecting their users, then I think it is a good thing that it's being advertised. I think it's good to bring it to the public's attention that this is something we all need to be cognizant of, that you have to be aware of what you're using, how it functions, what it collects about you, who it shares that information with, and how that information is shared. If you're unconcerned about your privacy, if you don't feel like it's a big deal, then I wouldn't worry about it. But there are always negative implications for data about you falling into the hands of folks who may use it in a way you don't want them to.
Can you give us some examples of that, Beth?
I think, you know, for me, it's more annoyance than anything. Let's say I Google something that I want to purchase. So I look up, I'm looking for a new tent right now. I want to buy a new tent for camping. So I Google tent reviews, backpacking tent reviews, and I want to look at websites that give me reviews of the top 10 backpacking tents. That's great. I did that search. I read the articles. The next time I go to Amazon to go shopping, it's going to start putting advertising in my screen for those tents. The next time I open Facebook, I'm going to start seeing Facebook ads for tents. The next time I, you know, use another service that's purchasing that information from a company that collected it, I'm going to start getting bombarded with advertising about that topic, but it's probably not sending me those top 10 tents that I read about. It's sending me those top 10 paid for advertising organizations that paid to get in front of my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not seeing the information I was looking for. I'm seeing what was paid for me to see.
Yes, I think we've all experienced that for sure. And even if you purchase an item, you still get it, don't you?
Exactly. It's like, no, I already bought that. I don't need to see any more ads about it. I already have one.
Well, Lisa,
Yeah,
at least on Facebook, you can turn those ads off. So that's
you
kind
can,
of nice.
Yes. It gets frustrating when you feel like you're being manipulated.
Yes.
I think that's really the general feeling out there is just the manipulation that happens.
Yeah, I think you hit it right on the head. So no calls today. Where is everybody? 800-642-1234. I know you have a tech question, so give us a call. So much technology these days, you know, has AI and other features that add, you know, it's kind of, well, complexity, basically. So is there a place for, you know, older, simpler tech? And are there people out there that still like to use it?
Yeah, actually, here's a funny thing. I just heard that there is going to be a new phone release that's just like the old Nokia brick phones that we had back in the late 90s, early 2000s. Because there are a lot of folks, you know, I've heard a lot of like Gen X folks and millennials are kind of getting to the point where they're like, wow, I just really don't want to be that connected anymore. It's too much. And I need a little bit of a cleanse from being available to everyone at all times of the day. And a simple phone that doesn't have any apps on it that just lets you call and maybe text is some folks' answer to that.
Well, there is something called an off button that they could probably use.
Yes. I feel, though, like the self-control is what's really hard for folks.
Mm.
I actually will multiple times in the summer go on camping trips where I'm in places where there's no signal at all, and I feel like it's so freeing to just turn off my phone, put it away, maybe take it out to take a few pictures, but that's all I'm using it for, and to just completely cleanse myself of, you know, looking at the news or going on social media or being available to anyone else to call me for anything, you know, or to text me. I don't have to. So I think getting away from it sometimes is really helpful.
Yeah, I think we've seen a lot of studies that say the exact same thing, is that you don't have to have it with you all the time. We remember the day when we didn't, right? And we just survived
exactly. Just
fine.
Yep.
I kind of look at it like it's a convenience. Like it's, I can live without it. It's kind of like a dishwasher. It's great, but yeah. Anyway.
Now, if you can't leave the house, if you leave the house and you get 5 minutes from home and you realize you left your phone at home and you can't, you know, run an errand or go visit a friend or go to an appointment without it, that may tell you that you might need a little break from it.
Very true. Let's go to Luann in Green Bay. Go ahead, Luann.
Hi. I just wanted to thank you for mentioning DuckDuckGo. I was a librarian. I used the internet since it was green letters on a black screen, and I haven't liked Google almost forever. I do my best to avoid it, and DuckDuckGo is amazing. And I'm just saying, if we can stop using the word Google as when we mean search, that could help too. But DuckDuckGo is a great alternative. It's on my phone, my husband's phone, my iPad. It's on my Mac. I don't even use Safari. I just prefer DuckDuckGo.
Great. Well, thanks, Luann. Beth, you have a comment?
Yeah, that's a great endorsement for DuckDuckGo. A lot of IT folks that I work with use DuckDuckGo frequently as their search engine, mainly because of the privacy that's built into it and also to kind of not perpetuate the Google machine. So we do have a saying in IT, though, when someone asks us a question that they could have looked up themselves is, let me Google that for you. And maybe we need to change that to, let me search for that for you.
But Google is so fun to say.
It is.
Their name, their marketing, they did everything right on that one. So, but thank you, Luann. That's really nice to hear that people have been using it and they prefer it. So you've got an option. Karen in Madison, let's go to you next. Go right ahead.
Hi. I'm just calling. I'm not real tech savvy. I am on Facebook, but someone gave me a new cell phone on Apple, and so I activated it, and you have to use your thumbprint and a passcode, and so if then I was told you couldn't have the same passcodes, that you're not allowed, you know, they wouldn't allow that, but I'm getting in all the time, and she was right here when, you know, so I put my own thumbprint there. So can you just tell me if I'm giving my information away by using the same passcode, is that right that you couldn't have two passcodes with one person using, you know, one person using, I mean, two people using the same passcode?
So, Karen, do you mean that the person who gave it to you had a passcode and you are using the same passcode that she did?
Right.
Okay. Okay. Beth?
Yeah. The only thing there is the person who previously used that phone, if they get a hold of your phone, they'll know the passcode and be able to get into your phone with it. You can change the passcode on the iPhone in the settings. If you go into the security settings on the iPhone, it'll let you put in a new passcode if you want to change that to something that only is known to you. You do have to have that backup passcode on the iPhone in case the thumbprint doesn't work. There are times when the thumbprint reader may not be functioning properly, or, you know, it's smudged with something on it, and it'll ask you to put your passcode in instead. So that isn't something that you can get rid of, but you can change it to something that only you are aware of.
Okay, so that's your option, Karen. And I know I have problems sometimes because I put like lotion on my hands, or my hands have water on them, and it won't recognize my fingerprint at all. So,
And it's the facial recognition one, and sometimes it doesn't recognize my face. Like if I've been outside mowing the lawn and sweating really hard and my face is all red and I'm like, well, why can't you see me?
So. Or sometimes in the morning I'm like, oh my goodness, I must really look bad because they don't even recognize me. So.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
Yes. Well, kind of funny, I guess. So we were talking about some of the older tech that people are using. Do you have any examples of some of the tech that still performs really, really well?
Here's a funny one. I have a 17-year-old daughter who recently bought a Sony Discman, if you remember those.
I do.
She bought it at St. Vinny's, I think for a couple of dollars, and has started buying CDs for maybe 50 cents or a dollar a piece when she sees them at garage sales. And she has decided that she wants to own her media. That, you know, streaming media, you don't own anything, and they can take it away anytime. But if you have a physical CD in your hand that you can play in a CD player, then nobody can take that away from you. So the kids are kind of going back to some old school technology, and I'm happy to see it.
Yeah, I love it too. I've been doing that with DVDs because I have way too many, but like, why do people ask me, why are you buying those? Number one, they're a buck. Number two is, yeah,
right.
I own it and I don't have to worry about it being taken off of the networks that I, you know, subscribe to. I can watch it anytime I want to. There's really a lot of pluses. So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And I still use my iPod. So anyway, let's go to Alden in Wisconsin Dells. Go ahead, Alden.
Hi, I'm enjoying the show. So thank you. I was just wondering if your guest could offer a little advice on how to get started with a YouTube channel. For my particular interest is of spiritual and religious kind of programming.
Okay, thanks, Alden. Beth, have you done that?
I haven't started a YouTube channel of my own. I would think that, you know, a good way to start, obviously you want to sign up for an account as a creator so that you can host videos on it. I think a big, you know, challenge for YouTube when they're getting, when folks are getting started, is how to get the word out there about your channel and about your videos. And I've seen a lot of success if folks have a decent social media following. Let's say you've been on Facebook for 15 years and you've got, you know, maybe 400 or 500 or 1,000 friends that you're connected to on Facebook, to post a link on your Facebook to your YouTube channel to start getting friends and family and folks you're already connected to viewing your videos, commenting on your videos, and starting to create that buzz around your channel. And once you've got that going, you can ask folks that have engaged with your channel to then start sharing it on their social media sites as something for their network to start looking at and commenting on and subscribing to if you set up a subscription for it. But it's really getting the word out there and gaining that like first traction with folks to get them to watch your content and engage with your content is really the key to getting started on that.
Yes, definitely. And I have a YouTube channel that I've had for years and years with a variety of things up there. And, you know, I'm happy if I get 10 likes. So, and it's really nice stuff, Alden, I'm just saying. But yeah, you really need to get the word out because there's so many out there. It's really difficult to get there's a lot of buzz, put it that way, right?
Right. You really have to figure out who your audience is. In order to really resonate with folks, you know, finding a niche audience that you can then get your work in front of, you know, if you have very specific topics that you're going to be creating content about, finding other social media groups related to those topics and promoting your channel on those groups is a good way to, you know, engage with folks who are looking for content that's really specific to a certain topic. So really just finding your audience and making sure you're getting access to your content in front of those folks.
And when you're doing your description, make sure you put as many words in there as possible. So if someone is searching for whatever they're searching for, yours will come up as one of the options. So that helps too. So thanks, Alden. We're talking today with Beth D'Angelo. She's a senior IT specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, we'll talk about the safe storage and use of medicine with a pharmacy professor from Concordia University. And then we'll hear about the Native American Center for Health Professions at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And that's tomorrow starting at 11 right here on the Larry Mueller Show. So right now we're talking tech and we're going to go right to the phones. John in Elgin, Illinois, go right ahead.
I was given this Apple Watch, and I'm about ready to give it back. It was recently updated, and now all I get is this screen full of information that tells me all of the services that I can get if I enter my Apple ID. I don't know how to enter my Apple ID.
Okay, Beth.
All right. Well, so it's asking you to enter an Apple ID, but it's not showing you any of the actual applications or anything that are on the phone?
No, you can't.
Okay.
It won't do anything except give you this information.
Okay. And is there anywhere to enter your Apple ID in on that screen? Is there like a box where you can type it in? Can you scroll down on it? Is there a way to scroll all the way down to the bottom of that informational screen?
Yes.
Okay. And maybe there may be a button to continue if you scroll all the way down to the bottom of it.
You know, it'll scroll for about an hour before you get to the bottom.
Oh, it'll just keep going. Interesting. It sounds like you might need to do just a hard reset on the watch. And there's a way to do that. Let me just grab the instructions for it. Force restart. Okay. So you're going to hold down the side button until there's a little power button on the screen that appears. And you should be able to push that or drag that power button over to shut it off and then turn it back on.
Which side button?
It's the circular side button, I believe.
All right.
Yeah, hold if you down. Just press and hold that. Mm-hmm. And if you hold that in for 10 seconds, it'll actually force the restart. And then you'll see the Apple logo appear.
No, I'm holding it. Nothing happens.
Okay. Well, we're probably not going to have time to do the whole thing for you, John. But should he just go to I found that just Googling that, I hate to say Google, searching for that online will give you all kinds of information about how to do that, right?
Yeah, it may be that you want to take it into the Apple Store and have them do a reset to defaults on it so it clears out that error.
Yeah, and maybe they can also tell him, you know, some of the things about the watch that he may not know, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. They can help you with learning how to use it.
Sure. Well, good luck, John. I know how frustrating that can be. Anne in Madison is up next. Go right ahead, Anne.
Hi. I have a question, very simple. How do I change my search engine on my iPhone?
Yes. If you're using, the Safari browser is the one that comes with the iPhone, so that's your default browser on your iPhone. If you open that up, let me get mine open so I can just walk you through the steps real quick. All right. Safari browser. I think we need to do it in settings. If you go to the settings on your iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And you keep scrolling down until you see Safari in the settings.
Mm-hmm.
You go into Safari. There should be a place in there where you can set the default search engine.
Okay.
And you want to change that to whatever you want to use for your default search engine. So if you want to use DuckDuckGo, you can fill that out with the DuckDuckGo.com, and that will become your default search.
Very simple. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling in, Anne, with that question. I think half our audience right now is doing that on their phones. I was tempted, but I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
We've got an email from Lance that he said he recently got a new tablet, and like a previous tablet, the new one seems to drop connection from the router at home. It loses connection, then it reconnects after 10 or 20 seconds. Is there a setting that Lance could tweak on the tablet, or is it a sign that Lance's router is getting his word flaky?
Yeah, it may be that the router itself just needs to be rebooted. Oftentimes you just need to turn the power off to it and turn it back on, let it cycle back so that it's back online and then reconnect to it. That connection can get a little, like you said, flaky if the router's been on for a prolonged period of time without being rebooted. Some hiccup could be happening at the router level that's causing that disconnect, and I'd say 9 times out of 10, a reboot of that piece of equipment will fix it.
Mm-hmm. Routers can get older and not work as well. Is that right?
Yeah, it's true. So that the signal that your router is putting out, especially if you're, it's a Wi-Fi router, eventually the parts within that piece of equipment start to wear down. The signal strength can start to taper off. You can end up starting to get what's called signal attenuation, a little bit easier, where it's dropping packets of information, or you're getting disconnects from your network. And it's really just the breakdown of the hardware that you're using, starting to not be able to emit a signal as strong as it could when it was new.
Is that something that's kind of even over the board, like it's going to be 3 years, 5 years, or does it just depend?
I think it really depends on the quality of the router that you're using. If it's just a kind of a cheap consumer grade one, I would guess you could probably get 5 years out of something like that before it really starts causing problems. The other thing is often there are updates that are released for hardware like that if you install the update, it may fix some sort of a glitch or a problem that you're having. So I would check to see if there are any newer updates for the piece of equipment you're using that you could download and install that may cause it to become more stable.
And you can do that through your laptop or?
Yeah, usually it's called updating firmware. And if you go to the website of the vendor who made your router, they generally have instructions for how to do that for your particular piece of equipment.
Oh, great. Good to know. Karen called to ask how to turn off Facebook ads. That was my fault for saying that. But you don't really turn them off in that you...
Right.
Go ahead and explain it. You're the expert.
You can go into the privacy settings on Facebook and you can really kind of tailor how the ads are shown on your Facebook page to your liking. You can't really turn them off completely, but you can tell it what ads you want to see and what ads you don't want to see. And that would just be in the settings of your Facebook account. If you go to the little gear icon on your Facebook page, you should be able to get into the privacy and security settings and make tweaks to that.
And another way that you can do that for ads that keep showing up, which is the stuff that drives me crazy, is there's three little dots on the top of that ad on the right-hand side. If you go into that, then you can make your preferences known, and you can make that ad go away and never see it again. So feel the power.
If you're getting one that's really annoying, and it's one specific ad that, every time you're watching a video, this stupid ad pops up with a jingle that's driving you nuts, you can click on the ellipsis, that three dots on the ad, and it'll give you an option to don't show me ads like this. And it usually asks you why. And my default answer is it's annoying.
Yes. And it is. So
yes.
If you've got a question for us, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And we have got an email from John in Mount Horeb. He called to ask what the difference is between a pass key and a password.
Yeah, that is a good question. So a pass key and a password are kind of used interchangeably, but a pass key specifically refers to an encrypted, it's, how do I explain this in really layman's terms? it's something that's generated using a cryptographic technique to encrypt a key code. Whereas a password is a known set of letters, numbers, and symbols that you can type in to unlock something. So a passkey is usually generated through an encryption, a piece of encryption software that you have a key, and on the other side where you're sending, a piece of data that's encrypted, they also have the key so that they can open it. So it's more physically having one key in two separate places to open something rather than a password that's just a known series of letters, numbers, and symbols.
Okay. Well, that was a very easy to understand definition. So thank you, Beth.
Great. Yes.
Ethan in Central Wisconsin emailed to say that they own a small business and is worried that their computer systems are falling into ransomware attacks or other cybersecurity issues. He hosts his own local server and utilizes a password manager. They said that they also use BitLocker on his devices. What else could Ethan do to keep their intellectual property and client files safe and secure? You've got 1 minute.
All right. Well, BitLocker is a great start. It's a really helpful encryption software that really reduces the threat of data theft or exposure. So if you're using BitLocker, you're probably ahead of most folks in the small business world. Another thing I would make sure I'm using is some form of virus protection and malware protection software package, like a Norton 360 or a McAfee, any one of the bigger named software packages for cybersecurity will give you the firewall security. They'll give you the virus protection, malware protection. They'll even give you optional VPN services. You can use it across multiple machines. They do have server versions of that if you have a data server in-house that you said you're using. So I would look into one of the larger antivirus and cybersecurity protection companies for subscription.
Okay.
Doing that.
Way to go, Ethan. You're definitely being smart. We're talking to Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. We'll be back after a little bit, but if you've got a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. We're Talking Tech on The Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau. Beth D'Angelo is back with us today. She's a 20-year veteran in the field of information technology and a senior IT specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Give us a call with your questions about tech, 800-642-1234. All the lines are open. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And we did get an email from Judy in Oshkosh, Beth. She emailed to ask how to find a safe site for a 10-year-old to connect with an international pen pal.
A safe site for that?
Yeah,
that's a good question.
It is.
Yeah, an international pen pal. I don't know. I think maybe... other than, using, general sites that you would connect with through that and then monitoring that connection, I would think it's hard to find something that's moderated to the point where I could call it safe without you keeping an eye on it as well. So what I generally recommend is that, if you're going to have your kids or teenagers using the internet, if they're going to be using social media or if they're going to be on online chats that you use some sort of a monitoring service to keep an eye on what they're doing online. Most of the services now will not actually like show you in real time what your kids are doing on their devices, but they will monitor for any concerning communication and they will alert you if there's anything you need to know about. So a service that I've been using for quite a long time and that I've recommended to many people is called Bark. Like Bark like a dog.
Mm-hmm.
Bark is great. You can install it on any device that your kid's using. It'll monitor any or all of their social media, their email, their text messaging, their Snapchat, whatever service they're using to communicate with folks. It will actually monitor those services and send you an alert if there's any concerning content.
So that's an app that you can just download, I'm assuming, from app stores?
It's not a free service.
I'm sorry, you just broke up a little bit, Beth, so go ahead.
Sorry about that. Can you hear me now?
Yep, we're good.
Okay, yeah, it's a service that you'll have to pay for through a subscription. You sign up for it, and then you can install it on as many devices as you need to.
Oh, great. Well, that sounds like a good investment.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. Glenda emailed to ask how a Roku streaming device compares to cable TV. Is one better than the other? Well,
yeah, I think, the Roku versus cable, the big question is like with a Roku, you're going to pay a monthly fee to have that device. You can sign up for whatever streaming services you want to use through that device. So you can pick and choose which streaming services you subscribe to. And it can be a lot less expensive than a cable service. And you can then kind of pick and choose the content that you want. So it's a little more flexible, I think, having a Roku versus paying for cable.
And generally, if you don't decide to subscribe to every streaming service out there, you will save some money generally. So good luck
with
that.
You will. There's also a lot of free content that comes through the Roku library. You don't have to pay for any of it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You're going to find a lot of services that have advertising, but these days that's kind of par for the course. Yep, exactly. So so we just heard that the Trump campaign was hacked. And, you're wondering, as just a regular person, they got hacked and they're supposed to have all kinds of security. What can we do to secure our own computers? Or if we're a small business, how do we do that?
Yeah, the Trump campaign hack is kind of unusual because it's been done by a state actor. So this is Iran is actually claiming that they were the folks who did the hacking, or the Trump campaign is claiming that the Iranians are the ones who did the hacking. So, these state organizations that are hacking kind of higher profile, large companies, universities, hospitals, presidential campaigns, politicians, and the like, they're using tools that are far more advanced than the consumer market is really capable of protecting against. So it is always that that the folks who are trying to steal information are always one step ahead of folks who are trying to protect the information.
But in order to keep yourself protected, some of the advice that I've given on this show and in other places is to make sure you're using an up-to-date antivirus and anti-malware protection service. So something like a Norton 360, a McAfee, one of those services that's going to download updates for viruses on a weekly basis so that you have the most current protection available to your systems. You want to make sure you're really careful when you get an email from somebody that you don't know and there's a link in it. If you don't know this person and they're sending a link to you and you didn't ask for this email, clicking on that link could, unwittingly expose you to malware that will steal information from your computer or steal your own personal information or allow someone else to use your computer to do something illegal. So being really careful in vetting the sources of information that you're getting, not clicking on links from folks that you're not familiar with, keeping your system up to date with security updates for the operating system and for your virus protection software. Those are all really good practices that can help ward off any of those attacks.
Okay. So is like just slowing down, right? I mean, we tend to just click, yeah, click. And then before you know it, you're somewhere where you didn't want to be.
I've really come around to using the saying, read all the words.
Yeah.
In so many instances in life. And I know that it sounds really cumbersome when you get these, five-page long end-user license agreements that
yes.
nobody reads.
No.
But oftentimes, reading all the words can save you from a lot of grief later.
Mm-hmm. So true.
So making it a point to know what you're getting into.
Yep, for sure. Let's go to Leon in Racine. Go ahead, Leon.
my name is Leon. I'm from Racine, Wisconsin. And I'd like to know, I just got rid of my computer towers, and I took the drives out of them. Is there any way I can take those drives and put them to a thumbnail to put in my laptop?
Yeah, actually, so if those are hard drives that you took out of a tower, in order to connect them up to something else, you'll need, there's a device that you can buy that is like an adapter that will allow you to plug a hard drive into it and then connect it to your, if you have a laptop or another computer that you're using, you can attach it as another hard drive so that it looks just like your hard drive that's on that device already. And then you can move files from that old hard drive onto your new one, or you can move them onto a thumb drive that you may have plugged into that computer as well. But you'll need a hard drive adapter that will take the type of hard drive that you're trying to plug it into. My suggestion is if you have a local computer shop around that you bring the hard drives in with you, and they will know what kind of connectors you need for that type of hard drive, and they will point you in the right direction for the device that you need to make that adapter connection.
Okay, thanks for the question. I mean, that's something we don't think about too often is that, yes, there are local computer places that can help you with things like this, right?
Absolutely. I know in the Madison area, I've used Madison Computer Works for about 20 years for hardware, asking them questions about what's compatible with what. If I have an old piece of hardware that I need to repair, if I'm looking for something that I can actually like test before I buy it, you really can't count on the big box stores anymore. The only one around us that has computer equipment really is Best Buy. They have a pretty small selection, and the folks that work there really don't have the expertise to help you with making things work together that you didn't buy all of it together at their store. So I would definitely look into your local computer shop. They're great resources.
Yeah, and if you don't know if they're a good shop or not, ask your friends, because more than likely they've used them before. So,
and look for Yelp reviews.
Yes, definitely. So there was a semi-recent iPhone update that automatically makes your phone join public networks if you're near them. Maybe we should turn that off. What do you think?
Yeah, that's something that you can ask turn off on your phone. Right in the Wi-Fi settings. So if you go into your settings and then you go into Wi-Fi, you can tell it to ask to join networks. So it'll prompt you whether or not you want to join it. I think it's a little bit dangerous to automatically join public networks because they're not always necessarily the most secure network. It
you know, can directly connect you to tens or, you know, dozens or hundreds of people that are connected to that same network at the same time. Those folks may have ill intentions of trying to steal data from folks that are connected to that network at the same time. So I'd be careful about joining public networks unless they're a known quantity, and I would turn that setting off so that you're asked if you want to join it rather than it just automatically happening.
Okay, sounds good. I've got a question for you. So printer, you know, printers are the bane of everyone's existence, at least the home printers are. So I got this, it's a tank jet or whatever they call it, a tank one, you know, it's got more ink in it, right? Thought it was a great idea. Well, this printer, after about a year and a half, it jams up constantly. It's like it's not picking up the paper. When it does, it jams up. So my question is, I haven't bought any new ink for it. Should I just get a new one, or should I try to actually find a place that'll fix it?
Yeah, so it's probably not worth fixing the printer. Generally, the cost to fix them is more than the printer would cost to replace. Oftentimes, the ink is what's the most expensive for the printer, and the printer itself is relatively inexpensive. If you can buy something that takes the same type of ink and use the same refills that you have, that's a good way to save some money. But I haven't heard great things about the tank printers. I've heard that because they don't have the self-contained cartridges, things can get gummed up a little bit in them, and they often need to be recalibrated or cleaned to function properly.
I have noticed that. It does, it's not the best. So,
right.
Yeah, so until someone comes up with a new kind of printer, we're kind of stuck with the other ones, right?
Right, we're all stuck with buying those cartridges that cost more than the printer.
Oh, gosh, such waste. I just hate that.
I agree.
We've got a question about how safe it is to use your phone to tap and pay for things as opposed to using a credit card or, God forbid, those paper checks.
Yeah, I think the one thing you've got to worry about with saving your credit card data on a phone to use to pay for items is that because it's a device that's internet connected, there is the potential for somebody to steal that information from your device. Now, if you're talking about like an iPhone or a Google phone or an Android device, usually there are protections built into the software that they're using to store that encrypts it and makes it very difficult to actually get that information off of your phone. But you're going to want to make sure that you have the latest security updates on your device. You certainly want to make sure it's password protected so you don't leave your device wide open for somebody to just find it if you leave it on a table somewhere at a restaurant and then be able to use it to go pay for stuff without you knowing. So I would certainly password protect or with your thumbprint or facial recognition, ensure that that's done.
And that's something that we've talked about a lot on this show is the fact that you need to do those updates, right?
Correct. Yeah. The security updates are really critical for making sure that your devices are staying ahead of the folks that are trying to steal information from those devices.
Mm-hmm. Our guest today is Beth D'Angelo. She's worked in IT for more than 20 years, and she can answer some of your questions. So give us a call, 800-642-1234. We still have 10 minutes that we can help, so give us a call. You can also send us an email, talk@wpr.org. Sometimes, especially I've noticed this summer, you know, your phone gets really, really hot. My iPhone will just say that it's too hot and kind of just turns itself off. What should we worry about that? Or your laptop? I mean, they get so hot. Is that a problem that we should be, you know, concerned about?
Yeah, the nice thing about most newer devices is they have kind of a kill switch in them that when they reach a certain heat, they won't let you use them so that they can actually cool down before you do any further damage to the device. I know that oftentimes with phones, having it in a protective case can make the overheating a little bit worse. It doesn't have an opportunity for the phone to kind of breathe where the battery is, so that cooler air doesn't get to the battery. So if you want to cool it down faster, if it does have put that warning up saying it's too hot, I can't use it right now, take it out of the case, maybe hold it up to the air conditioning vent in your car to cool it down if you had left it on the dashboard and it got real heated up, or put it in the shade to make sure it's not in the direct sun. But the phone itself will shut it down itself down before it gets to a point where it's going to start, you know, physically affecting the hardware.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah, I've noticed that a lot. I put my phone up to use for GPS, and the sun coming in will definitely make a difference. We've got a question from Jude in Appleton. Go ahead, Jude.
Hi. I am wondering why no one has mentioned a laser printer. I bought a laser printer after buying so many ink cartridges 2 years ago, and I have never replaced the laser in it.
What do you think, Beth? Is that a good option?
Yeah, laser printers, the price is going to be more expensive than like an inkjet printer or, you know, a typical consumer-grade printer. So you're going to pay more for the actual hardware up front, but you are correct that they do use far less of the ink or toner that is required for the laser jet printers. They are more economical, so they use less ink. They also have much larger ink or toner cartridges that you put in, so you don't have to replace them as frequently. They carry a lot more ink. The ink itself is actually more of a powder than a liquid, so it's less likely to kind of gunk up the mechanisms, the mechanical stuff in your printer as well. It's just they're going to be a little bit more expensive up front, and then you'll spend less on ink in the future.
Mm-hmm. And they have color as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, color laser printers do get a little bit expensive, but you know, if you're going to be doing a lot of printing, they're often a lot more economical than your inkjet printer.
Okay, great. Jude, thank you so much for that option. I may have to look into that. Tom in Green Bay, you're next.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Every once in a while, I get this pop-up on my computer that says, your computer has been hacked. Call this 1-800 number. And what I've been doing is just unplugging my computer at that point. Don't hit any keys. Just unplug your computer. Let it sit for a minute or two and then plug it back in. Am I hurting the computer or am I doing it wrong?
You're not hurting the computer by what you're doing, but it's probably not solving the problem. And, you know, if it keeps coming back, likely what's happened is your computer may be infected with a piece of malware, which isn't quite as destructive as a virus would be, but it can be really annoying. What they're trying to do is to get you to call that number and scam you out of money to sell you some virus protection that you don't need. So usually those things can be cleared up by running a malware scanner on your computer, and that will show you what's on there and ask you if you want to delete things that are causing those problems. My recommendation is using a product called Malware Bytes. If you go to their website, it's a free download. You can run that scanner on your machine. It'll tell you if there's malware on there, and then you can remove it through that program as well.
Great. Thank you very much, Tom. Jeff in Barry Mills, you are next. Go right ahead.
Yes, I was wondering if you could recommend a QR code reader to install on my Pixel 2 XL.
That's an Android, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so a QR code reader. So you're talking like a scanner that you want to attach to it, are we talking about an app that you would download to install on your phone?
Well, you tell me. Just a QR code reader that I can scan
right. The
QR codes when.
Yeah, that's actually built into the Pixel phone. So there's an app on there that's called QR Code Scanner. And it came with the version 13 of the Android phones. So anything version 13 and above has it in the quick settings menu. So if you go to your quick settings menu and you look for QR code scanner, it'll pull up an app that'll do that for you.
Simple, Jeff. So go ahead and try that out. QR codes are just amazing, aren't they? They've really become popular. Is that something that's, you know, that we could create ourselves? Say, you know, we have an event or some group that we're in needs to use it. Is it pretty simple?
Yeah, there's plenty of places where you can generate QR codes out on the internet. If you want to use just a free website, there's QR.io is a real simple one. It allows you to create free QR codes. You can point them at any website that you want to. You can include, you know, lots of information.
on whatever site you point to. So they're a great way to direct people to information without having to have them, you know, write it down. I know a lot of folks are now putting QR codes on their business cards so they can put less information on the card and let you go to a website to read all about them. It's also really helpful for folks that are like selling products at, say, let's say you're at a craft fair and somebody is selling and they want to use Venmo as one of their ways of collecting money from you. They can put a QR code that'll lead right to their Venmo account and you can scan it with your phone and pay them immediately through that QR code. So pretty handy.
Yeah, I've run into that a lot lately. It's just really interesting how many ways that they're being used by organizations you never would have thought.
Yeah, I saw recently that someone got a QR code tattoo on the back of their leg. And when you scan it, it takes you to a YouTube video of Rick Astley singing Never Gonna Give You Up. So it is a Rickroll QR code tattoo, which is like really the most 2020 thing I've ever heard of.
That is hilarious.
People are really creative out there.
Yes. I thought you were going to say, you know, medical information. Oh, no, it's not going to be that.
A troll. They're joking.
Yes. Heidi,
but that's not a bad idea for medical information.
Well,
I like it.
Yeah. It was not going to wash away. Heidi in Green Bay, let's take your question before we wrap things up. Go ahead.
Sure. Sure. So I installed a new router for our Wi-Fi. I was able to connect our phone to the printer by changing the IP address in the phone, but I can't get my iPad to print to it. I've rebooted everything. I was able to connect one time by rebooting it, waiting 30 seconds, and then it connected, but then later on it dropped it. Is there anything I can do to get that working again on the iPad?
Yeah, so you'll have to make sure that the iPad is connected to the same Wi-Fi network as the printer, obviously. You want to, when you go in on your iPad and you add printers, is it actually seeing the printer available at all?
It doesn't show the printer, right? It says no air printers found.
No air printers found. And what brand of printer is it?
It's an HP.
It's HP. Download the HP printing software onto your
computer. I am able to sometimes, and sometimes I'm able to print with the HP app, but I was hoping to be able to just print as I had been by hitting the print button and finding an air printer.
Yeah, I've had really mixed luck with using the air print feature, so I generally actually use the printing app from the vendor of the printer to make it work more consistently.
Okay, good luck, Heidi. I've had the same problem with that. It's finicky. Beth, thank you for being with us today. We really appreciate your time.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me. Great to talk to you, Jill.
Great. We'll see you in a couple of months. Beth D'Angelo is the Senior IT Specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology and a more than 20-year veteran in that field. Up next, Deanna Springer is with us, and she's a marketer and moderator for the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show that's coming up early next month in Madison. Stay with us. The Great Wisconsin Quilt Show turns 20 years old next month. I can't believe it. The expo was born out of the ever-long running Sewing with Nancy, the PBS TV show hosted by the late Nancy Zeman. I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is the Larry Mueller Show. Thanks for spending some of your day with us on WPR. Deanna Springer is back with us in the studio. She's Vice President of Marketing for Nancy Zeman Productions and moderator and co-president of the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show. And Deanna also co-hosts the YouTube show Stitch It Sisters, which runs with the Nancy Zeman Sewing Studio in Beaver Dam. So are you a quilter? Have you attended the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show? Do you recall watching Sewing with Nancy on PBS? Well, we'd like to hear from you, so give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Thanks for being here, Deanna.
You're so welcome, Jill. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Well, I just can't believe it's been 20 years already. I feel old.
It's amazing. The years have gone by really quickly.
It certainly has. So it's coming up next month. What are the days?
September 5, 6, and 7 mm-hmm. at the Exhibition Hall at the Alliant Energy Center right here in Madison.
Yeah. So is that Thursday, Friday, Saturday?
Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
Yeah, because I know some people think it's Sunday, but it's not.
Right, mm-hmm. right. That would be the Garden and Landscape Expo goes on Sunday.
I know. It's confusing.
Right. Quilts, Nancy always wanted a Sunday for faith and family, so we've never been open on Sunday at the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show.
Well, that makes sense.
We set up on Wednesday, so we're there for 4 full days.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that we, you know, many hands set up the show in one day on that Wednesday before the show.
Because it's huge. It's really big.
Right.
So for those who haven't been there, what can they expect to see?
Well, it's a quilt show. So there's a central quilt exhibit. It's a 10-category juried and judge competition with category one is, say, bed quilts, hand quilted bed quilts. And then all the way up to category 10, which is mixed, and it could be wall quilts and mixed techniques. You'll see every possible modern to traditional and mixed inside of that central quilt exhibit. Surrounding the central quilt exhibit is an 8,500 square foot vendor mall. All the vendors are selling supplies that you can sew your own quilts with, from fabrics to sewing notions to quilting supplies and tools.
And these days, there's not as many fabric stores as there used to be, so it's kind of hard to find things that are unusual, isn't it?
And it's a joy to find them, too. It's a big thing, a big deal in Wisconsin and all over the United States to go shop hopping. So we get a carload of people together, or two or three or five carloads of people, and we go shop to shop. We go shop hopping and shop all the different quilt shops and fabric stores. Oh. They're out there, and they will be in person at the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show.
That's really nice to get that background information. And you've got classes too, right?
We offer tons of education. So we have lectures, sit and sew workshops. Sit and sew means you're going to sit at a sewing machine and sew a project. We have hands-on workshops, which are no sewing machines, and you do hand quilting or dyeing or different techniques like that. Stage presentations are included with your admission ticket to the show.
Mm-hmm.
And evening events too.
Oh, evening. Well, like what? What's the evening event?
We have a special evening event this year to celebrate the 20th year of the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show. We'll be celebrating 20 years with presenter Ann Wonky. Ann Wonky has been with us since the beginning as a very popular teacher and friend of Nancy's. So she is going to host a wonderful evening on Thursday, September 5th. And it's a 90-minute presentation that starts at 6 p.m.
90 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot.
We'll look back over the last 20 years. We'll have some photos going way back to the beginning.
Oh, very cool. People love to see that. Mm-hmm. That's great. That's great. So what are you going to be doing at the show besides running around like a chicken?
I'll be hosting the live interviews. We'll go live every morning, every half hour with PBS Wisconsin, and we'll be on the World Wide Web at quiltshow.com.
Nice.
You can find the links. We'll be at the Quilt Show Facebook page, the YouTube channel. And we'll be start broadcasting on Wednesday, setup day.
Great.
So we'll have some behind-the-scenes looks into this show. I'm also teaching. I teach every day at 1 o'clock, a lecture.
Okay.
And it's 10, 20, 30 minutes to quilt. So teaching how to quilt. If you just have 10 minutes a day, 20 minutes a day, or 30 minutes a day, you can make a quilt in a year if you do that.
Sure. I'll trust your opinion on that. You know, a lot of these quilts are not your grandmother's quilts, are they? They're some of them are just way out there.
Right. They're works of art.
Mm-hmm.
Fiber artists like to make. Makers like to make. We're very tactile with our hands, and that's why we like to go to all those fabric shops.
Yes.
It's like our paints. You know, you have to build our paint box with all our different supplies and fabrics. And each quilt in the central quilt exhibit, and also we didn't talk about special quilt exhibits that are coming in. Each quilt has a story card with it, so you can read about the quilt, what inspired the quilt, what is the pattern for the quilt. And many of them are unique, one-of-a-kind quilts that the quilt makers create.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see everything from traditional piecing to applique, modern touches with beading or hand dyeing. pictorial quilts that tell a story. Every quilt really tells a story, but
sure. If you are working on something for that long and you're touching it so much, it's going to have a
story. It's a labor of love.
Yes.
Literally, blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah, blood, sweat, tears.
Right,
for
exactly.
Sure. For sure. You know, this all grew out of the, for Nancy's long-running television show, which I loved, Sewing with Nancy. Tell us about her legacy.
Sewing with Nancy. Nancy started in 1984.
Wow.
That's 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. So we're still on public television. Sewing with Nancy's on public television now for 40 years. We recorded our last show in 2017 before Nancy received her terminal diagnosis. She passed away from cancer in November 2017. But I had the amazing pleasure to work with Nancy for 27 years.
Really?
Right till the end. Wow. And then she passed the torch to me. It's a different role nowadays than it was then. But she started her business from her kitchen table. And she went to University of Wisconsin-Stout. She had a major in clothing and textiles and a minor in journalism. So she was, you know, in 4-H when she was a youngster. Her mother was actually her 4-H leader in sewing. So her mother always pushed her really hard. And for many people, perhaps you don't know, Nancy had Bell's palsy. So half of her face was paralyzed since she was 13 months old. So her mother never wanted that to hold her back. And her mother texts me once in a while. It's great to hear from Barbara. If you're listening, hello, Barbara. So really, the foundations of 4-H and Nancy's education mission, she taught the world to sew, starting with small little guild meetings or seminars and in Minnesota Fabrics in Chicago, where she met her future husband, Richard Zeman, who owns Nancy Zeman Productions. It's still a family-owned company. And really, she traveled the world teaching sewing and quilting, and of course through the television was her main teaching venue. But that created lots of invitations for her to travel the world, and we traveled coast to coast each year at different quilt shows and sewing shows. So when Nancy approached public television, PBS Wisconsin, it was probably 2002 or 2003, about producing the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show as a fundraiser for PBS Wisconsin, and kind of like Garden Show, Garden and Landscape Expo, but also a hybrid of everything that we learned through traveling to quilt shows and sewing shows to make it the best show ever.
Well, I mean, I think you probably are there at this point. You must get people traveling in from all over the world.
Right. We do have people travel internationally and from all across the 50 states. So It'll be interesting. We keep track of that. And we have a little map at the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show that shows where everybody came from. So,
oh, that's great.
Right. And we're expecting, you know, around 20,000 people this year.
Mm-hmm. And for those who don't feel like they can come to Madison, like you said, it's out on the YouTube channel. What do they Google or search for?
Sure. Search for the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show.
Uh-huh.
Or if you're at YouTube, search for the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show. Or just go to quiltshow.com and we have links to all of our different sites from there.
Mm-hmm.
And we do actually have people watch from across the globe. Each year we record 4 lectures and we push those out through those channels throughout the year. So We always have something going on for the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show all year long.
All
so
year
there you
long.
Go. If you can't make it, you have lots of binge watching to do.
There you go. Well, and you're talking about Nancy's legacy, and she started this like so before the internet, and it just translates so well to the internet, doesn't it? And her old shows are still available, right?
Right. It's what we know how to do. We teach through video.
Yeah.
So we know how to share that mm-hmm. way, especially with our partners at PBS Wisconsin. We could not do this mm-hmm. without them. You know, they have the A-team, Nancy. I always called them the A-team.
The A-team. Mm-hmm. And so many of us were lucky enough to grow up with people in the family who sewed and were able to teach us. But that's not necessarily the case anymore, is it?
So, not always. Mm-hmm. I hear about half and half. Mm-hmm. Grandparents or a mother, aunt, uncle, someone taught them how to sew, or they experienced it growing up
sure.
all around them. And others, not at all.
Yeah.
They didn't have a sewer or a quilter in the family that they remembered.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, many generations ago, many more homes did lots of sewing and quilting. So there's people that have never been exposed to quilting that come to the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show that we teach. There's a different variety of options available to you, really whatever you're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter just started quilting 2 years ago. And she chose the most difficult pattern there is.
Of course she did.
Yeah, the double wedding rings.
Oh, so, yeah, that's a simple one.
And really, you just sit down, you cut the fabrics, follow the directions, watch uh-huh. the videos, mm-hmm. come to the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show and learn it step by step. That's probably the most frequent question I get asked. Which classes are for beginners?
Yeah.
Well, just go to the classes that interest you and you can start at any point.
Mm-hmm.
And explore, and you'll find yourself finding interest in multiple different things. So many of us quilters have many different projects going, from a piece quilt to, we're making bags, or we have many projects going.
Yes. As not a quilter, but a sewer, I can definitely relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking to Deanna Springer. She's Vice President of Marketing for Nancy Zeman Productions. She's a moderator and co-presenter of the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show. Deanna also co-hosts the YouTube show Stitch It Sisters, which runs on the Nancy Zeman Sewing Studio in Beaver Dam. So join the conversation and give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can email talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, we'll talk about safe storage and safe consumption of medication. And we have a guest from Concordia University, a pharmacy professor. And then we're going to talk with the director of the Native American Center for Health Professionals. And they're at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. That's tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show. Right now, we're talking about the Great American Quilt Show, right? Is that get the
Almost.
Name?
Almost. We're getting that big. The Great Wisconsin Quilt Show.
Okay, we got it. So you were talking earlier about making quilts and starting from just basic stuff here, do something you love. What kind of equipment are we looking at? Because you can go from, a needle all the way up to this quilting machine, which is really expensive. So what do we need to start?
You can start anywhere from hand piecing with a needle and a thread and some fabrics.
Mm-hmm.
There's English paper piecing that you could do in your lap while you're riding in the car or traveling, that doesn't take up much more than, a pencil pouch worth of supplies to get started. And then you can go all out with the best sewing machine that you can find and have a room full of fabrics and patterns and supplies and notions and tools. So all those people started somewhere that have those large elaborate sewing and quilting rooms.
Oh, yes.
And you'll find all the supplies you need at the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show in that 8,500 square foot vendor mall.
Mm-hmm.
There are over 125 vendors coming from across America, a lot of local Wisconsin vendors, and some international ones too. But you'll find everything there from all of the sewing machine companies. So this is your one time a year you get to go from booth to booth and booth to booth and try all of the different sewing machine offerings that are available to you right in one spot.
Yeah, because it's really hard to pick out a sewing machine, isn't it?
Yeah, it can't. Well, not for me.
Not for you. I'll take that one and that one.
right. And that does happen. Trade in and trade up. Not doesn't always happen. People collect sewing machines. And you'll hear people as you walk through the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show talking, how many sewing machines do you have? Oh, I have 12 sewing machines. Oh, I only have three. Right. Or you have one. One is just great.
Sure.
In the, you know, from a straight stitching sewing machine, you can do a lot of piecing and quilting and put a beautiful quilt together from a pot holder size to a wall or a bed quilt.
Is it a good idea to start small? I know you said your daughter started big, but does it
She
make
broke
you feel...
it down. I broke it down for her one, you know, one block at a time, one piece at a time. She and I actually went to a year ago, September, to a Victoria Finlay Wolfe, who'd been a Sewing with Nancy guest. She's a modern quilter.
Okay.
And we went to her workshop for 5 days. So,
Yeah.
Wow. My daughter Terry had a lot of moms teaching her that week. Yeah. It was a lot of fun. But basically, Victoria and Nancy, you know, all of us quilting teachers, you break it down into easy steps. Nancy always said, eat that elephant one bite at a time.
That's so true.
That's why her 10-20-30 method of, you know, teaching really works, because you just break it down in easy steps. And, you know, the designs look very complicated. You'll hear words like Bargello quilts and all sorts of different things. And right at the front entrance of the Central Quilt Exhibit, you'll see the Kids Quilt Challenge. And so even kids 15 and under are invited to make a quilt and enter it. So everyone starts somewhere from there to the Mod Minis in May. Each May annually, the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show, we host a Mod Mini Quilt Challenge. So those quilts can be very tiny. So now we're talking postcard size, almost placemat size. But think of all the elaborate things you could do to a very small quilt. 24 inches or smaller, you can go all out and you put every technique into that quilt, or try every technique and put it into a Mod Mini.
Are you sewing these? It's so small. It's like sewing Barbie doll clothes.
Right. Well, there's something called seam allowance.
Okay.
And quilters usually use a scant quarter inch seam allowance, which is just under a quarter inch. But when you press the seam over, it equals a quarter inch. when you're sewing something really tiny, like a very tiny quilt, you use larger seam allowances and then trim them away. That's the secret to that. You can make a very tiny log cabin quilt, but the secret is to use large half-inch seam allowances and then trim them away.
Oh, goodness. Talking about trimming, what do you use for trimming? Do you use the rotary cutters? Do you still use the scissors?
Mostly rotary cutting in quilting, So in addition to if you're sewing quilts by machine, you'll want definitely a rotary cutter that looks like a pizza cutter, only smaller. It was designed in 1980 in Japan. And you need a special rotary cutting mat, too, so you don't ruin your table or your blade. And rulers. You can have one ruler, and then you can build your collection of rulers depending on what you're interested in making. A lot of fabrics are cut with the rotary cutter. And now we have the AccuQuilt.
Which is?
AccuQuilt is think about a cookie cutter for fabric. So you can, it's a die cutting machine that you can, there's three different options available, from a small go meet up to an electric AccuQuilt. And you prepare your fabrics, and then you know, if you wanted to cut a bunch of gingerbread appliques, you just run it through the machine with specialty dies, so you can collect the different shapes of dies, from triangles, half square triangles, diamonds, Dresden, everything you can think of. There's a die for it that you can use with the AccuQuilt. So that's a very modern thing to do. It actually came out of education for cutting paper and shapes and numbers and things for the teachers' bulletin boards. That's how they got their start.
Yes.
And I'm sure one of those teachers was a quilter and said, hey, we need one of these for fabric.
Yes. So I've heard about those machines that pop out all those great shapes. So you also do something that is very popular, and that is quilt appraisals.
We do quilt appraisals. So you want to sign up in advance, and you can sign up in advance for all of the educational offerings we're talking about, including your admission tickets at quiltshow.com. You want to do that ahead of time so that we can prepare your tickets and get ready for your arrival. And the quilt appraisals is one of those offerings. You can make an appointment with a quilt appraiser to have your quilt appraised. So once you've submitted your information that you'd like a quilt appraised, then you'll have instructions that you bring your quilt along. And you'll have an appointment. You can be with the appraiser while they look at it. They'll want to see different things. If you bring any history you know about the quilt, even if you don't know anything about a quilt that you have, they can teach you, you know, when these fabrics were manufactured. So they can date it and they can give you an estimated value for that. And that's for a fee.
And what they will give you in return, something you could maybe insure it if
need
be?
Right. You'll receive a written appraisal a few weeks after the show. Mm-hmm. It's not like Antiques Roadshow where you'll find out that day what the value is.
That's no fun.
They'll take it home and we have two quilt appraisers and they do research. So there's many hours that they put into each quilt appraisal. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting. You can watch. We have chairs. And the public can watch as it's included with the admission ticket.
So besides having a history of this quilt, is it important, or what is it important, the condition, I'm assuming? What other some of the points that they
Right, condition, and I'm not a quilt appraiser nor a quilting judge, but I've been around quilts for many years. They look at the condition, the vibrancy, the quality of the stitches, the fabrics used, the supplies used, the batting used, the backing, the workmanship is a big part of it. There's a lot more to it.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you, what makes a quilt a quilt? I mean, you have certain...
Right. For the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show, all of our quilt challenges, quilt contests, the quilt must be made with a fabric top, a batting in the middle, and a backing fabric.
Okay. That's simple
enough.
So
if someone submits a quilt, and we it's juried and judged, so you submit a photo, two photos of your quilt, actually, one of the entire quilt and one a close-up, so we can see the stitching and the piecing. And it must include all three layers. And then you can take it from there. Working within, and it should be quilted through all, it has to be quilted through all layers, whether it's hand or machine.
Sure.
And that's what makes a quilt.
Yeah. So when you talk about quilting, for those who are not aware of it, what's your definition of quilted then?
Quilted? Mm-hmm. Well, it would be with thread, and it would be through all layers. Right. It would, if it's hand quilting, you know, you'd come up from the bottom and go back down through the top. Think of the quilting bees.
Right, right.
Where all the women from the community would gather around and solve all the community problems right there at the quilt frame while the kids sat underneath and fed the needle
back up. Right. Yeah, that's great. I love
it. And the machine. There's machine quilting. Mm-hmm. Gorgeous. I mean, hand quilts are incredible. Mm-hmm. The amount of work that goes into that.
Yes.
And then there's the machine piece or machine quilted quilts that, wow. And now with the new long arm machines, that work can get really intricate.
Yeah.
But really the most impressive quilting to me is the hand quilting and then the free motion quilting, where your hands are moving the fabric and manipulating the fabric and creating stitch design on the quilt.
Mm-hmm.
That's an art form.
It certainly is, because it's not just following the blocks. It's
right.
All kinds
free
of
motion.
Other things.
Free
yeah,
motion.
It's great.
Yes.
Okay, so we've got about a minute or so left. So give us all the details once again.
Great. Well, come to the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show September 5, 6, and 7 at the Exhibition Hall at the Alliant Energy Center. Head over to quiltshow.com to learn about all the offerings. We didn't even talk about the Quilt to Give community service project that we do each year in the atrium. That's where you can sit and sew if you've never sewed before. The public is welcome to sit and sew with your admission ticket there. Lectures, workshops, hands-on, stage presentations, vendors, 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 and quilts, quilts, quilts.
And if you get your tickets online, it's a little cheaper than at the door.
Right. You can come right to the door and purchase tickets too, but you'll save $2.
Absolutely. Everything helps. So, Deanna, thank you for joining us again. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Deanna Springer is Vice President of Marketing for Nancy Zeman Productions, as well as moderator and co-presenter of the Great Wisconsin Quilt Show. Deanna also hosts the YouTube show Stitch It Sisters, which runs the Nancy Zeman Sewing Studio in Beaver Dam. Thank you for listening to Larry Mueller's show on WPR News Network. This and all our shows are a team effort. Our producers are Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. Technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. I am the executive director, and of course, our host is Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening.